Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Hello, Felicity. So I am finally back from my very long holiday. And guess what? One of the first things I did when I got back was...
You made yourself a cocktail because you were missing them.
No. Well, I did do that, but no.
Of course you did.
Of course I did. So the answer is I returned to our A Question of Drinks inbox, which was quite full because somebody, no names clearly, hadn't cleared it for a while.
Really?
Yeah, really. Anyway, I found the great question that we had in from Baptiste, who is based in France. Now, he works in wine and he says, everyone is now talking about storytelling, but is it really important for consumers? So he goes on to say, if I follow Ehrenberg Bass, Mark Ritson, etc., I'm not sure that it is.
That is a really good question. I'm glad you brought that up, Baptiste. We will work on that question for you.
It is a very good question. So not only is it a really good question, but I think it's going to be a little bit controversial in this episode. Yeah. And I think that potentially we're going to annoy quite a few people with our respective views.
Yes, we're going to make many enemies with this one to get you back in normal life.
Okay. Exactly.
But before we go about destroying our reputations, how about you catch me up on your 3-month sabbatical in Central America? What was your big takeaway?
I learned that I really like sunshine and empty beaches even more than I thought I did, which I didn't think was possible. But more seriously, ish. I also learned that if you're somewhere warm enough, kind of any cocktail becomes really quite good.
Oh, really? Do you have a framework for that?
No, but I should do. I'm sure there's someone out there. But you've also been on the road, haven't you? You've been travelling to Italy, I believe. Mm. So what were you up to in Italy?
I was there recently. So I was judging the 5-star wine competition in Verona, which is only Italian wines. And it's always amazing because every year the Italians seem to have found another ancient and undiscovered indigenous grape variety. So there's always something to discover.
And they're always indigenous, are they? So
they're
just
always
keep popping
up. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Very handy. Very handy. So fascinating. But let's get back on track to the episode.
To
back
work.
To work. So storytelling. So definitely a big, really big topic. I think it seems to fill up way too much of my LinkedIn feed with experts banging on about how storytelling is the savior of brands. So having said that, I've declared my interest. Do you want to declare yours?
Well, as much as I agree with you about LinkedIn and how irritating it is, I must tell you all that I'm a guest lecturer in brand storytelling at the University of Cape Town Business School. And I've been doing storytelling talks and workshops for almost a decade.
Thank you. So declarations up front. So it might not surprise you to learn that I think that the premise of storytelling, based on what I just said, as the savior of brands, is overrated by marketeers and underrated by consumers. So conveniently for us, that sets us up nicely to have one of our debates, Felicity.
Okay, let's get into it. But I should warn you that my views are probably more nuanced than you might think.
Of course they will be. I'm sure we'll still find plenty to disagree on.
Damn right we will.
Yeah. So let's dive into the question. Is storytelling overrated? So I'll be the proposer and argue that storytelling is most definitely overrated.
Okay, and I'm going to argue that it's not. In some circumstances.
Okay.
But first, how about we define what storytelling actually is?
Okay, well, I know that's an easy one. I know the answer to that. A story has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Correct. And it's a much more sophisticated structure than people give it credit for. It's like red corner, blue corner on steroids.
It is, I know, but we went to the triangle one at some point, didn't we? I can't remember what that was.
Complicated things, yeah, that's right.
It was a three-legged stool. There you go. Anyway, so Felicity, tell us, why why do we tell stories? I'm guessing there's more to it than simply being entertaining.
Yes, that's right. So many people have theories about this, but the anthropologist Robin Dunbar has said that one of the reasons we developed language is not just to share information, but so that we can gossip about one another.
We want to
track who did what, who can we trust, who can't we trust, and who's having sex with who. Mm. So storytelling probably arose and is an extension of this. And of course, there is always the entertainment angle. If you're stuck out on the savannah with nothing to do at night except stare into the fire, you will probably appreciate the person who knows how to make the day sound entertaining.
Okay, so I need to stop you right there. I hear the evolutionary argument that you've sort of been talking about there, but the researchers at Ehrenberg Bass would say none of this matters for a brand if consumers can't recall you, are not aware of you, and find you on the shelf in the first place.
Look, that is a fair challenge. But before we talk about brand awareness, can I talk about how stories act on the brain? Mm. Because that's the difference between storytelling that builds a brand over time and storytelling that's just noise.
Okay, all right. But I will keep coming back to the consumer angle, as you would expect, and this idea of sort of staring at the wall of wine. Who, for example, has more than just a few seconds to decide?
Fair point.
Yeah, but I'll let you get back into it. So okay, tell us about storytelling.
So I'll take a bit of a detour. I'll tell you a story. Oh, how about that?
Okay.
So from the early 19th century onwards, anthropologists started to get interested in this whole question of storytelling. And they discovered that there are big payoffs to people who can tell a good story. Now, at the same time, you had folklorists. You had people like the Brothers Grimm in Germany, who mm-hmm. were really interested in collecting all of these old stories. And so people began to do this across Europe. And what they began to notice is that lots of these stories, despite coming out of very different cultures, had things in common, which led to theories of what you might call narrative templates.
Okay, narrative templates. Is that like a real name or have you just made it up?
Oh, I actually made it up and I'm going to claim that one. But I think it's quite a useful framework. Mm. So the psychotherapist Carl Jung called them archetypes drawn from what he called the collective unconscious.
Okay, so this is the idea that there are sort of six or seven, I can't remember how many stories in the world, and basically everything is just a variation on one of those.
Yes, more or less. I mean, there's this guy called Vladimir Propp who said like there were 31 units that you could mix and match. So there's always a villain, but the villain could be a dragon or a witch or something.
Yeah.
But additionally, so as well as, you know, how stories function, what they've also been interested in is whether a skilled storyteller gets any particular benefit from their skill or if telling stories benefits the community in some way.
So as in whether the storyteller gets more food, for example, or the whole group develops, I don't know, a better awareness of their environment.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Now, the paper that proved this once and for all was published in Nature Communications in 2017, and just in time for a talk I was giving on storytelling, which was great.
Yeah.
So a team of researchers went and lived with a group called the Agtas, who's a hunter-gatherer community in the Philippines, and they found that communities that had a skilled storyteller in the ranks showed higher levels of cooperative behaviour. So the stories were actually functioning as a way to maintain social norms.
Okay, and then for the storytellers themselves, what benefit did they get?
They had better reproductive success.
Okay, is that a polite way basically of saying they got more sex?
That's exactly what that means, yes.
Oh, there's a skill to develop in life,
there
isn't
is,
there?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, carry on. That makes sense. But when you need to remind everyone of where the tigers are hiding, for example, is there any evidence that telling stories in a business context brings you more rewards?
Well, the evidence is mixed, all right, because it's a harder thing to study. So Robert Cialdini, who was the researcher on influence, he established that narrative and social proof are extremely powerful ways to persuade people.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there because I would argue that social proof and storytelling are two different things. So social proof is basically us taking a shortcut from other people's behaviour. So it's lots of people are buying it, drinking it, recommending it. So we assume it's the right choice. But that's not really storytelling, is it?
No, but he also established that narrative was a good way to persuade people. But there's also the work of sociologists Melanie Green and Timothy Brock, and they developed a theory they called narrative transportation, the phenomenon whereby people absorbed in a story reduce their critical resistance to the claims buried within it.
Which I guess can be a positive benefit from a marketing and a brand point of view then.
Yes, and there's a lot of research that shows that people remember stories much better than they remember logic or arguments. So if you embed your facts in a narrative, it becomes stickier.
Yeah, which is one of the strongest arguments from the sort of prose storytelling crowd. So the psychologist Jerome Bruner wrote that there are sort of two modes of thought. Now, I can never say this one. You know me and my pronunciation, Felicity. So is it paradigmatic,
I think is what you're saying.
Paradigmatic. Why can't I can never say that? So anyway, there are two, paradigmatic and narrative. So the paradigmatic mode operates through the logic. It's the logic one. And the narrative mode organizes experience through human action. And this is much easier, therefore, he's saying, for us to remember stuff, to remember
things. Yeah, that's
things.
Right. And this is where the whole thing comes unraveled, particularly with wine storytelling, because what is critical in all of this is the way the story or the narration is organized. That's what makes it memorable.
Okay, so that's one of my bugbears about storytelling. So when everyone is saying this wine is made in a vineyard and, you know, we've been here for centuries, et cetera, et cetera, nobody can distinguish between those stories because they're kind of the same.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But there's an even more fundamental problem.
Okay.
So remember when I said there are these narrative templates? It turns out that the more you deviate from these, the less memorable the story becomes. It just doesn't have that sticky quality that you need.
Okay, so we're back at the idea that there are, back to this idea, there's only kind of six or seven story frameworks. You call them narrative
templates.
That's
right, and you have to stick to them. I mean, they're very flexible. Mm. So earlier this century, both the Stanford Computation Labs and the University of Vermont separately spent time feeding lots and lots of books and stories in their computers to try and test this idea of sort of universal templates once and for all.
Okay, and what did they find? Were there these kind of six or seven narrative templates?
Yeah, well, according to the University of Vermont, there are six stories in the world. So there's the rags to riches story, for example, which they call the rise story. Mm-hmm. There's the Icarus story, which they call rise and fall. And then there's Cinderella, which is one of the most widespread stories in the world, which is rise, fall, rise. And there's three other variations.
Okay. So I can see how those stories might be rise and fall or whatever. But what does that mean in terms of influencing people?
Well, they can be hugely influential. So my favorite example of how powerful these stories can be is Trump's slogan, Make America Great Again.
Okay.
Now, not because I like it, but because it's a clear example of a Cinderella story. It implies America was great once, which is the rise, but now it's not, which is the fall, but it could rise again. And so it's a very powerful story in four words.
Yeah, it's incredible, actually, when you put it into that context, isn't it? Because I hadn't thought about it like that before. And I can actually see that, for example, with many organic or biodynamic stories, you know, where people say they bought the property, it was in really bad shape, they renovated it, and now it's flourishing. So it's that kind of, that arc again, that story
absolutely
arc.
Those are all Cinderella stories. Mm. Now, the problem, of course, is that everybody tells the same story, and so they dilute it. So effective stories need to have the right structures, but they also have to have stakes.
Okay, so you're saying that something important needs to be at stake in the story, in the Cinderella narrative, or there has to be a problem or a conflict, so some kind of, that needs a resolution. Solution so that the story has memorability.
That's right. And if I could just do a detour here for a second.
Oh, okay, so it's usually me that does tangent time. You're taking over from me, Felicity.
I am, because it's really interesting. So there's research from a professor, Paul Zak, from the US, and he's looked at what actually happens in your body if you hear a story that has very high stakes.
Okay, but so apart from him having a really cool name, can you give me an example of the type of story he's talking about?
Yes, here? And he's made a video which you can find on YouTube, which I really recommend. So he got an audience and he told a story, this story about a father who's watching his son playing. Mm-hmm. But the father knows that his son is dying of cancer.
Gosh, okay. So that really is very high stakes. So what happened?
Well, so he took, Paul Zak took blood before and after people watched the story, and he discovered that the story had provoked a rise in cortisol, which is the stress hormone that you need to pay attention to something, and oxytocin, which is the bonding molecule. So people who had a rise in both cortisol and oxytocin gave more money to charity immediately after watching the story.
Okay, but that's what many charities and not-for-profits use. So isn't that kind of playing on human empathy and us putting ourselves in the position of the protagonist? Which I guess is why, you know, we watch movies, read books, go and see plays, et cetera, and that's why they work. So I'm now thinking, how high do the stakes need to be for us to be bought in the way that Paul Zak was measuring here?
Well, I'm glad you said that about human empathy and putting yourself in the mind of the protagonist, because that's what a good story does. It actually hooks you in and makes you part of the story.
People have
done functional MRI and actually can track this in your brain that, you know, if it's a horror movie, for example, you get provoked fear in your brain. So, but interestingly, you don't need very high stakes in order to provoke a reaction. All you need is a dramatic reversal that hooks your attention. And this is where using the right structure works.
Okay, so we're moving into framework territory. I approve, Felicity.
Indeed. So when I'm doing storytelling workshops, the framework I use is something called Freytag's Pyramid. Now, he was a 19th century playwright, and he obviously wanted the secret of success. So he analysed a huge corpus of plays, and he discovered they were all structured the same way. The Freytag's Pyramid has some sort of inciting incident that has a problem to be solved, and then the stakes get higher and higher and higher, and suddenly it all comes to a head, and then the story resolves, either for good or bad.
Okay, so again, can you give us examples?
Well, Penfold's Grange is a really good example of this.
Okay.
So you've got the Australian winemaker, Max Schubert, who decides to try and make a wine of the calibre that he'd experienced in Bordeaux.
Okay, so in your sort of template narrative here, that's the problem to be solved.
That's right. So he starts working on it, he works and works and works, and then management at Penfold's tell him to stop and abandon the project.
So this is the bit where the stakes are getting higher.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But he keeps working on it in secret, and now maybe he's jeopardising his job, so the stakes are going up. And then at the resolution, management tasted the wines again and recognised that these wines were something really special and that Schubert had created something unique, and the wines went on to win international awards.
So the underlying principle here then is that most people typically remember the reversal bit. That's the key.
That's right. So nobody remembers the start of the story, which is Max Schubert goes to France and gets excited and then decides to make that. But they do remember the bit about he made the wines in secret and then all was revealed and all was well. So if you lay out most stories according to Freytag's Pyramids, and I've done this in workshops, people walk away with a very powerful story about themselves.
Okay. So going back to Penfold then, I'm going to put forward a different view, because I would argue it's their distinctive brand asset, so the typography, the colour, etc., used consistently, that underpin their positioning, and that's much more significant than the story of Max Schubert.
See, I agree that those things are very significant, but I don't believe they could have built the brand from the start without that very memorable foundational story. I mean, and just on this, stories have another function for companies, which is that they remind people internally where they came from and what they stand for, and that guides decision-making. And you can see this in Penfolds. Penfolds are acutely aware of their origin story and what they owe to that, and it sort of guides how they decide to do things today.
Okay, so I'm going to start a sentence, which I was told my children not to. Yes, but, or no, but, even worse. Okay, I hate to be the voice of cynicism here, Felicity, but if all of this is true, then why is wine storytelling still so forgettable? Because, you know, there aren't many Penfold stories floating around in the level of success you've just been talking about.
Okay, so this is a problem. It's because most of what people call wine storytelling actually violates these basic principles. They don't have stakes, they don't have reversals. And I know this because a few years ago, I actually sat down to map the stories of various wineries. No, because I was doing it for I was giving another workshop, so I thought I'd demonstrate how storytelling works. So I actually sat down and started plotting it out on a graph.
I'm not smiling, Felicity, because I don't believe you. Of course you did. And then did you write an article about
it? Yes.
Of course you did.
Okay.
Tell us.
So this was all European wineries. And what I found was they all started, and this was regardless of whether it was Spanish, French, Italian, whatever. So they all started with the founding of the winery, and then things went upwards from there. So there was typically a win at the Paris exhibition of 1880-something. There was post-war success, and then somebody came up with a brand, and then it was modern-day wonders, and then it was just, you know, Parker points galore, and it was just success after success. So it was this incredibly straight line.
So they didn't have this core element that you were talking about earlier, which is the reversal bit.
That's right. And what really interested me was that many of the wineries I looked at were in regions that had been, you know, hugely affected by things like phylloxera and World War I and World War II. But there was nothing about those events to be found in their timelines.
Yeah. And I guess they buried those bad memories effectively.
Yeah. And I did enough of these things that I came to understand that not only do Europeans in particular not want to tell you about bad things, but in countries like Spain and Portugal, they absolutely have good reasons not to. So They came out of dictatorships in living memory, and nobody wants to revisit the bad old days.
Exactly, exactly. So let's summarise the story so far.
Okay, so I assume that wasn't intended to be a pun, but it probably
just,
was.
As I said it out loud, I realised.
And it's a role reversal. Again, I'm usually the one that says, please summarise.
Okay, okay. No, that wasn't meant to be.
Yeah, it was.
You've given us, well, genuinely wasn't, but you've given us a lot of upfront theories there behind why storytelling works. So where we've got to is this, in summary: storytelling is powerful because it taps into how humans make sense of the world, but it only really works if it follows one of these recognizable structures, particularly having stakes and reversals that gives people something memorable to hold on to.
Correct. Good job. You're after my editor's job, aren't you?
Oh, God, no. I'd be absolutely hopeless at that. Right. All of what we said so far, then, is about the role and structure of storytelling and it being very credible. But there's a big problem, Felicity. So I want to put the case forward that storytelling itself is overrated as a business tool, which is how wineries in particular, often want storytelling to function.
All right. Give it your best shot.
I'm going to try. So my first argument is based on the research that our friends at the Ehrenberg Bass Institute, which I referred to earlier.
Hang on. Let me say, for new listeners who are coming in, the Ehrenberg Bass Institute that we talk about a lot is an Australian marketing science research body, best known for Byron Sharp's work challenging conventional brand loyalty theory. And he argues that growth comes primarily from reaching buyers who rarely think about your category. Is that a good summary?
It is. And it's also about salience.
Salience.
Yes. Yeah. Don't forget salience, which is coming to mind at the point of purchase. But very good summary. Thank you for interjecting.
Okay. So yes. I'm sorry. The door is open to you. Carry on.
Thank you. So back to me. So exactly as you've just said. So buyers need to think of you, as I was just saying, with salience there when they're in that buying situation. And to do that, as I was just saying, they must recognise the brand first.
Okay, so I agree with all of this so far.
Okay, well, that's very kind of you. So the problem, though, is that we have, despite what you've said, and may I say you've made a very good case for storytelling, is that, and this is the problem, in the real world...
you say that and you're about to try and knock me down. Don't butter me up.
Am I doing the arc of like Jeopardy stakes reversal? I don't think I'm on that. Anyway, in the real world of brands and consumers, Felicity, purchasing, which is what it is all about commercially, of course, purchasing, storytelling doesn't automatically mean that we'll create a memory for our consumers.
Okay. Yep. Go on.
Okay. So if storytelling worked the way the wine industry thinks it does, wine should be one of the most powerful categories in the world because it has more stories than kind of pretty much anything else.
Okay. So if it, quote, works the way they think it does is the key phrase here. As I've said, the problem is that a lot of what passes for wine storytelling actually violates the most basic principles of storytelling. But I'm going to stand by saying when it's done properly, it's very powerful.
Okay, so can we have an example where you show that storytelling has led directly to a brand success then? Give us the evidence.
19 Crimes. Okay,
oh, okay,
so It's a Wine. They have built a successful wine brand almost entirely on storytelling. The convicts, the backstories, the augmented reality app where the labels come to life and speak to you, that is classic storytelling.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that one up because that's actually the example I wondered if you might use.
Oh, did you? Oh, yes. Did you? You've got a defence ready, have you? Let's hear it.
Okay, and here's the important bit. So 19 Crimes doesn't succeed because people stood there reading a really long, beautifully crafted narrative about 18th century convicts. It works because the story was embedded in the brand cue itself. The label is the story, the faces, the name and the slightly unsettling mugshots that they have. So it effectively has become the distinctive brand asset.
See, I think you're wiggling here because storytelling doesn't have to be a long narrative that you sit and tell somebody. The fact that it's in the label still makes it storytelling. So the execution doesn't change the fact that they're still telling a story, Luli.
Oh, okay, but I think what's happening there is it's the DBA, it's the distinctive brand assets that are doing so much more of the heavy lifting than the backstory. Because if 19 Crimes had relied on a paragraph on the back label explaining the convict story, it wouldn't have worked. And that's my core point. If your story doesn't translate into something that people can see, recognize, and use instantly, then it's not doing much that matters for the brand. And that means that what we're making is not influencing the buying choices, which is what we're after at the end of the day. We want people to buy our stuff.
All right. What I will concede is that when you use storytelling plus all of the other distinctive DBAs. Things you're talking about, yes, indeed, it can be very powerful. But you tell me, you're the lady with the data. What does the actual evidence say when it comes to the importance of storytelling and how people choose wine?
Okay, I thought you'd never ask for some data, Felicity. Thank you. So
I have to throw you something.
You have to be kind to her. So this is where it becomes very real. So let's look at the evidence from IWSR in terms of how consumers, what influences consumers to actually choose wine. So label colour, typography, bottle shape, price points, promotions, you know, they as a starting point.
Look, I wouldn't disagree with any of this. And I do think that brands that use storytelling effectively also invest in branding, market typography and all of those good things.
Yeah, and I think this is where one of my heroes, Danny Kahneman, is incredibly helpful for us. So I think this is primarily what I was saying there about distinctive brand assets. It's all about how we process information. So effectively our system one and system two brains.
Look, you've been away for a long time. You're going to have to explain that system to me again.
Oh, okay, system. Oh, I'd love to. Thank you for asking. It's one of my favourite topics.
Is it?
It really is. No, genuinely it is. Because I think it's so important. It's so important to understand how communication actually works and how we process stuff. So this is where Kahneman is really helpful. So system one, that's the part of the processing in our brain that's fast, automatic, effortless, and crucially, uses a low amount of energy.
That's pretty much my entire brain. So if there's a system two, which is it?
Okay, so system two is the second type of processing. This is the stuff we do that's slow, deliberate, effortful, therefore uses lots of energy. And that's the important bit. System one is basically our sort of unconscious processing. And it's the bit that the brain that just sort of gets on with things almost in the background.
All right, can you give me a branding example of that?
Yes, I can. So, for example, when we see the McDonald's golden arches, we instantly think about, you know it's McDonald's, you know it's fast food, you know roughly what you're going to get. It's kind of zero effort required.
So it's just a mental shortcut, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And so you're not doing this massive sort of semiotic or story breakdown. You're just, you know, recognizing the logo, system one processing, done.
Okay, so that's branding at its best, creating those fast automatic associations.
Yeah, and there's a really important biological point here. So as animals, we are designed to conserve energy.
This one is, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, if the bear comes into the cave, we've got the energy to kind of fend him off. So our brains are really expensive organs when it comes to energy usage. There's a huge amount of energy that we use. So wherever possible, we default automatically to the low energy system one. So if we can do something quickly, automatically, and without thinking too hard, we will every single time.
Hard agree. That's absolutely true. Yes. True of me anyway.
Yes. Lived experience.
Right.
That's what we'll call it. So system two is the opposite. This is the really deep thinking that takes lots of effort and lots of energy.
So this is when you're concentrating and working something out and your brain feels like it's full of cobwebs.
Yeah, exactly. And you really feel it. And you know, like you've been in a classroom all day or you've been in a long meeting, you just kind of feel exhausted. And that's because you've been using your system too, doing this really heavy duty processing going on.
Yeah, it was when I was a kid and I was studying and I'd have to explain to my parents, I feel really tired now. My brain doesn't work anymore. Yeah. Stop piling stuff on me. And they didn't believe me, but it's true. Your brain does get sort of a bit fried.
Yeah, you've got proof now. Yeah, you've got the proof. So, but here's the problem. So this is why I tell the long story again about system one and system two, is that a lot of storytelling, and wine is particularly guilty of this, is asking consumers to go into their system two processing.
Okay. All right. If you see storytelling as somebody telling a big long narrative, yes, that's true.
Okay.
So what are people doing instead of listening to the story?
Which the majority of consumers are absolutely not in the mood for when most of us are out shopping. Because in reality, we're standing in a shop choosing wine. Our brains are already full and we're not standing there thinking, let me carefully process the heritage narrative of this producer.
That's very true. I have to admit that I don't do that either.
Exactly. When you're buying your Lidl G&T, you know, is there a lot of system two going on there?
No, that's a shortcut. There? I see the can and I think to myself, put that in this trolley. I don't even think about it. It just goes in the trolley.
Exactly. Yeah. Didn't even know you'd picked it up. System one at its best. So when we're standing in the supermarket or the retail store, we're typically thinking, you know, things like, oh, did I put the bins out this morning? Can I get away with chicken nuggets again tonight? Why doesn't my boss understand that my ideas are better? And slightly more urgently, when did the price of tinned tomatoes become so expensive?
Okay, that one is genuinely stressful. It is. That takes a lot of adrenaline.
It does. And these all take up bandwidth. So we've got very, very little less for consumers to kind of, have energy for. So with a paragraph about your fifth generation family vineyard, you're basically asking them to switch into system two, which they have very little of, to slow down, to read, to interpret, to care. And most of the time we don't, not because we're stupid, but because we're busy and because our brains are trying to conserve our energy.
Look, I agree with all of this, particularly the tinned tomato comment, but I have to come back to my point that what wine people think is story is a category error. Storytelling is not making people study soils or, genealogy. Mm. It's telling them something that actually embeds itself into the brain fairly effortlessly.
Okay, so you keep coming back to this point. So I think it's time to give us all some concrete examples.
Okay, well, so one of the best examples of brand storytelling actually doesn't come from wine, not surprisingly. It's Patagonia. What do you know about Patagonia?
Okay, so now it's over to me for tangent time. Mm. So I was wearing a Patagonia fleece the other day, and my daughter and her girlfriend both saw it and said how much they liked it and said that I was really cool. Well, actually, they probably didn't use the word cool, but anyway, I'm sure they didn't. But that's effectively, that's what they were implying, because they said, oh, look, you've got a vintage Patagonia fleece.
Vintage, yes. I like that shorthand, but it's really old. I've got lots of vintage too.
Yeah, exactly. So do you know what? I actually bought that fleece on our honeymoon, which is almost 30 years ago. So that really supports my perception of Patagonia or my understanding of the Patagonia positioning, which is all about making their outdoor clothes to last, therefore meaning that they have strong sustainability, which clearly I am living proof of with my 30-year-old vintage.
Okay, so for my story about Patagonia, I actually made myself some notes and I was going to look up how you pronounce some of this and I didn't. I'm going to get the pronunciation wrong. All right.
Oh, so join me.
Yeah, that's right. So Patagonia's story is interesting because it maps perfectly onto Freytag's pyramid. So the founder started out as a rock climber in the 1950s and he taught himself blacksmithing so that he could make his own, now I think it's pitons, because the ones that were available were destroying the rock faces that he loved. So he made them and he sold gear from the back of his car and the company grew. But then came the reversal. He realised that the pitons that he made were causing the very damage that he'd set out to avoid. So he started using aluminium chocks that left no trace. So this is the rise-fall-rise structure.
Yes, but like I said, it's a great story, but I never knew any of that. And I, being the owner of a 30-year-old Patagonia fleece.
Yeah, but this is the thing. Storytelling is not just about consumers. People inside the company do, and investors know it. And every time they make a decision about Patagonia, they're thinking about how it matches up to the founder's story.
But I think you're conflating two different things here. What you are talking about, I would suggest, is positioning rather than storytelling.
Well, no, I'm going to stick to it being storytelling also because this narrative is endlessly reproduced as is throughout the media and through stories about Patagonia. It travels really fast and I think it's because of the Freytag's pyramid. But the end result is that consumers know it's got strong environmental credentials, even if they can't really explain why. So lots and lots of companies have tried to create this kind of green halo and they've never been able to do it.
Yeah, I agree with that bit. But I would argue that Patagonia is actually proving my case more than yours. So the reason that the green halo stuck isn't because of the story, it's because every decision that's been made in Patagonia is consistent with a single clear positioning. And as far as consumers go, the story sits on top of everything else. So it's not the positioning that, it's not the storytelling there, it's the positioning. And that's exactly where I think the wine industry gets confused, Felicity.
Well, I think the wine industry gets confused about this anyway. But in the case of Patagonia, I'm going to argue that the storyteller is the fundamental block on which everything else, including the positioning and the branding and the distinctiveness and topography, actually sits. But okay. Can I get you to define positioning?
Yes, you can. Yes. So I define it as the set of associations you want people to hold about your product or your brand. So it is, for example, what you stand for, who you're for, and what makes you different. But the key one is what you stand for. And if you go back to the original definition from the work of Rees and Trout, who are two of the kind of best authors in the area of positioning, it's what you do to the mind of the consumer, not what you say. So it's actually what's landing in the consumer's mind.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to argue with that. And I want to say something else from what you've said, this idea of what do you stand for? And I think this is a problem as well. I think a lot of wine companies think they stand for something, but actually they don't. They're pretty generic.
Yeah, and that's a really good point to bring out. But if you're not arguing with me, then maybe I'm not being clear enough.
Don't worry, we'll get back into arguing in a second,
oh,
I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm saying it's not about crafting a narrative. It's about creating a clear, usable meaning. So April Dunford is really good on positioning. I'd really recommend people to look at her website or potentially read her book, which is called Obviously Awesome.
That is a great name for a book.
I know. Really
that's a great
good.
Name for a kid. I'm sure somebody one day is going to name their kid Obviously Awesome.
I know. It's such a great name for a book. Anyway, I'd really recommend it. I think there's some, it goes into a bit too much detail on positioning for me, but I don't think we need to get that complicated. But I think there's some really good stuff in it. And she basically says positioning is about making your product the obvious choice for a specific customer at a specific situation.
Look, I don't think any of this undermines the idea of storytelling. I think what is really clear is that storytelling is not sufficient on its own. That's the point.
Yeah, okay. So this is where this reliance on storytelling can go badly wrong, though, because people start writing the narratives before they've had those strategic decision-making or prioritization on positioning.
See, while I disagree fundamentally, Lily, with your disregard for storytelling, a very ancient art, as we've established, yep. I keep coming back to the very fundamental problem, which is that wine storytelling isn't actually storytelling.
Okay.
It's more of a touching belief that if people just explain the product with more emotion in their voice, that customers will naturally fall in love with it. Whereas, of course, as we know, the barriers to entry are much more significant than that.
Yeah, and the key commercial question then should be, why do people buy this brand and not the other brand? What is driving people's choices? So we could take, for example, like Coca-Cola as an example.
Oh, that's a big one. Go for it. Yeah. That's a very big one.
Oh, it is a very big one, but a very good one, because the positioning of Coca-Cola is actually really simple. Refreshment, happiness, shared moments. You don't need a story to understand that.
I will point out that Coca-Cola's Christmas ads, which tell a story, are very much promoting that view. But yes, I mean, storytelling absolutely can express that. It can bring all of those things to life and make them much more engaging and much more human.
Yeah, but it's not the strategy. So that the storytelling sits underneath the underneath that. It's the tactical execution. And I think that's where another problem is, that a lot of storytelling is actually quite self-indulgent, if we're really honest. Just because you love your vineyard and you think you're great, you know, why should consumers care about it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree with this. These narratives are not storytelling in any formal sense of what storytelling is. So, you know, what wine people call storytelling, and it's been a huge frustration over the years to listen to this, is it's a recitation of facts, all in the service of saying something about the thing they're proud of.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a perfectly fine thing to talk about, but they're not the same as the questions that the consumers are trying to answer when they're making their choices.
The word consumer, right. Now, when you talk about consumer, you are, of course, talking about a very particular type of wine buyer. And there are many different types types of wine buyers, including people who aren't just having a bottle to take home, but they're buying for, you know, other reasons like cultural or intellectual properties.
Okay, so I'm going to push back on you there, Felicity, because I am an all-inclusive person. By consumer, I mean and embrace all types of consumers. Yes, I might be talking about mainstream, I might be talking about collectors, I might be talking about occasional. They all come under the lovely umbrella of consumers. So your view is that storytelling plays a stronger, I guess, role for consumers who are seeking the sort of cultural or intellectual benefits that you were just talking about.
Absolutely. And if you do it well, it can give the wine great context and give a sense of meaning. Mm. So if you hear that the Frescobaldi family, who made the wine that you're now holding, also had Michelangelo as a customer way back when, that's something that's deeply reassuring. And you will absolutely tell that to the people you serve the wine to.
Well, I guess only if you knew that Michelangelo had good taste in wine, then it might support it.
We don't know that, do we?
Yeah,
no, it could have been terrible.
He could have been like,
good at marble, terrible at wine. Don't trust that guy's taste. Yeah.
Exactly. How do we know? But I do agree with you that storytelling can be more important, particularly at higher involvement levels.
Well, I'd argue that if the story is compelling enough, you can also use it as the basis of building brand cues. So the Champenoises are masters at this. Mm-hmm. So what does anybody know about the story of the widow Clicquot, for example? Probably nothing. But the entire Veuve Clicquot brand has been built about the story of her history, even if the person who buys the bottle isn't thinking about the mechanics of how it was all put together.
But I come back to the same point I've been making, Felicity, repeating myself. That is about consistent positioning, not storytelling per se. So here's the problem. The story is, again, not the engine. It's the tactical execution, the way of communicating positioning. And it's the positioning that is key. So take the example we were just talking about, Patagonia, as a key piece of evidence for my prosecution here.
I think what we'll have to agree on is that wine doesn't tell very good stories regardless of whether storytelling is useful or not. Yes. Because basically saying you're a family-owned winery that makes wine in the vineyards isn't compelling or original. No. However, I think I'm going to insist that there are a couple of places where storytelling is appropriate as a strategy and could work much harder than it does. So the first, for example, is TikTok and Instagram Reels.
Ah, so you mean make them into cinematic masterpieces.
Yes, that is indeed my recommendation. Yes. They should use a Hollywood budget and get actors.
Yes.
No, but short-form video is perfect for stakes, which you can script as problem solution. Instead, what people use is just this blurry lifestyle imagery that's quite meaningless.
Yeah, so how would you problem solution this? You know, if you've got 15 seconds or maybe a little bit more, but you've got a really short amount of time to do it.
The dog has escaped from the winery. Can you find it? Or people are picking grapes and suddenly there are storm clouds. Can they get the grapes in before it starts raining? It's really simple things like that.
Yeah, so those are basically the stakes that you were talking about. Yeah. And what's the other place for storytelling then?
If you're in a situation where you've got somebody's undivided attention, so a winemaker dinner. And in fact, I was thinking about this years ago because I was in Hong Kong a few years ago and a distributor actually said to me that people no longer went to winemaker dinners because somebody stood up and said, it's a family-owned winery and we make wine in the vineyard. And people could literally recite the script. And this is a moment that if you've got a good story, you can really get cut through.
Yeah, and I'll agree with a caveat that the person actually has to be quite a good storyteller for it to be good. So there's nothing more deadly than listening to someone go on about, this happened to me and then this happened to me and then this happened to me and when it still happened to me.
I think we've come to a place of agreement, Lily.
Yay. Okay, this is deeply unsettling and completely ruins our whole debate set up, Felicity.
Okay, so do we have an answer for Baptiste?
Sort of. So from my perspective, I do. So most brands don't have a storytelling problem, they have a salience problem. And if I take that one step further, positioning matters more than storytelling because it defines what you want to be known for. But even that isn't enough on its own.
Why?
Because in the real world, awareness and recognition rule, Felicity. If people don't notice you, don't recognise you, don't think of you at the moment of choice, nothing else really matters. You cannot story your way out of invisibility. And your conclusion, Felicity.
I think storytelling is extremely important for companies to help them understand who they are and where they came from. It is also the correct approach for social media marketing and for wine dinners and maybe when you're pitching importers and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. But it's not just useless, but it's boring and counterproductive if you're just reciting facts and cliches and calling it storytelling.
Well, that was a big old deep dive, wasn't it, to welcome me back from my sabbatical, Felicity?
Sabbatical, your holiday. Yes, it was. Okay, and anyway, if anybody else has another big question you would like us to tackle, please email us at aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
Where I will read it.
I'm glad you're back, Luli.
Thank you.
You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings as to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.